This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. Arthur Levitt is a former chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, a Bloomberg LP board member, a senior advisor to the Promontory Financial Group, and a policy advisor to Goldman Sachs.
Glenn Hubbard is the Dean and Russell L. Carson Professor of Finance and Economics at the Columbia Business School. He served as the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush, as Deputy Assistant of the United States Treasury Department, and was a consultant to the Federal Reserve Board. He's the co-chair of the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation and a past chair of the Economic Club of New York. His commentaries appear in Business Week, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The FT, and The Washington Post. He joins me now for a closer look. Glenn, have you been in touch with the Trump administration about economic policy?
I have, on some policy matters and thoughts about how policies fit together. Obviously, the team's working very hard.
What do you think they have in mind for changes at the Federal Reserve Board?
Well, I don't really know, but we know that the candidate said in the campaign that he's looking for more modesty at the Fed, you know, a central bank that's not focused on very large roles in the economy. And I would expect to see the appointment of a strong vice chair of financial supervision, something that's actually been required under Dodd-Frank, but President Obama chose not to appoint.
Do you think someone has assumed that position?
I really don't know. I mean, certainly nothing announced, and I don't know.
Now, we all agree it's time to reform the tax code. How would you change the corporate tax policy, and do you think there's any realistic chance that could happen?
Well, I'm very excited about tax reform for two reasons. One, I think it's the biggest single area in which policy can affect economic growth, and two, it's an area where the Trump team has been talking about very specific, very good reforms. So very large cuts in the corporate rate, broadening the corporate tax base, enabling companies to bring money home from the U.S., and reforming the personal tax code. I actually think it's doable because Congressman Brady in the House, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and Speaker Ryan have been working on this in the better way. So I'm absolutely optimistic it can happen.
Well, that would be really exciting. It's the first major change in tax policy for as long as most people can remember.
Absolutely.
Now, the House proposal is to replace the current corporate income tax with a 20% levy on U.S. companies' domestic sales and on their imports of foreign goods and materials. Exports under the plan would be tax-free. Is that something you're comfortable with?
Yes, the way I think about it is it's a cash flow tax with what economists would call border adjustments. Value-added taxes, which are consumption taxes, around the world have border adjustments. A cash flow tax and a wage tax together are a VAT, so I think it's quite doable. The hard part is getting something like that through. It's complicated. I mean, there are two issues in the tax bill. One is cash flow taxes don't have an interest deduction, and second, they have border adjustments. So I expect the business community won't be on the same page.
How would you like to see individual tax policy changed?
Well, I think we need to bring down marginal tax rates on business income across the board. Not all business income is done, as you know, by C corporations. A lot is done by individuals. So the House plan and what Mr. Trump talked about in the campaign would also bring down those rates. And, of course, milder marginal rate cuts elsewhere. To pay for that, you'd have to broaden the tax base, so limiting deductions and things like that. And, of course, a plan like this would cause some modest pickup in economic growth, which would help pay for part of it.
Do you think that interest on borrowings for home loans is going to be in the mix?
I don't know. I mean, some of the reforms that have been talked about over the years include an overall cap on deductions, you know, not any specific area, but I'm not really sure what the administration will do. Obviously, that's a very politically sensitive topic.
Do you think along those lines we should expand the earned income tax credit?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think that really helped propel President-elect Trump was the idea of looking out for the interests of people who are trying very hard in the labor market and whose incomes aren't advancing. And the Earned Income Tax Credit is thought of as a work support program, but it's actually more of a family support program. We need to expand it greatly for childless workers who typically are young workers just getting started. And I think it just makes a lot of sense, as well as redirecting funds we spend on training programs that don't work so well to pay for more individualized training. I very much hope the administration will do this.
Well, all of this, of course, is a function of what's going on in the economy, and we've heard a lot of conversation about high growth. Do you think that a 4% growth is in the cards, and what's the best way to get there?
Well, I don't think so for the long term for the U.S. In the long term, the growth in the economy is constrained on the supply side. So I think of hours worked and productivity, and 4% sounds aggressive. But 3% or a little better sounds more than doable to me. And there's a big difference over a long period of time between 2% and 3% growth. In the near term, I think you could get very rapid growth. We're already changing business people's what used to be called animal spirits and getting them more interested in investing and households and spending. So we could have a near-term pop in growth. But long-term, I would expect that we could be looking at numbers like 3% or a little better, which is certainly a lot better than we have been.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment with economist Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia Business School. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 12 minutes past the hour. This is A Closer Look at Glenn Hubbard, the Dean of the Columbia Business School, and former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy at the U.S. Treasury Department. I'm Arthur Levitt. Glenn, what do you think we can do to best reinvigorate the small business economy?
Well, I think it's a number of things. One is to get tax policy right for small business. That's mainly personal tax reform. Also, improving credit allocation for small business. People think of banks as financing a lot of small business loans. They don't do that much anymore. And I think changes in regulation will be very important there, as well as regulatory changes. But the overall best thing we can do for small business as well as large business is grow faster. And I think that's in the offing.
Now, American companies have just under $2 trillion sitting on the sidelines. Why is this, and how do we get them to invest that money in our economy?
It's a great question. The U.S. has a tax code that says once you've paid taxes overseas, when you earn money, you have to pay tax again when you bring it into the U.S. if the tax rate you paid overseas is less than the U.S. rate. So as a result, a lot of companies just leave the money outside of use in the U.S. It's crazy. One of the things both the House bill does and what Mr. Trump does is say, okay, you can pay a toll charge and bring this money back. And when that money comes back, it can be used for investing in plant and equipment, for hiring people, for paying dividends to shareholders, you know, pumping money back into the American economy.
Now, both McConnell and Ryan have warned that they considered current levels of debts very dangerous. And they don't want any tax overhaul or stimulus package unless it's deficit neutral. Would you tell them to accept some deficit spending now to get growth?
We'll have to see what bill comes out. Mr. Brady's bill is largely paid for because it has, you know, the loss of the interest deduction and border adjustments. But I think where Mr. Ryan and Mr. McConnell are definitely right is that we have to focus on the long-term fiscal situation. Neither side in the campaign talked about it much, but the math is inexorable, and it's not going away. We're going to have to get this right.
Glenn, are there any of Trump's campaign promises that you hope will be forgotten with respect to the economy?
Well, I think by and large, he has enunciated very pro-growth policies. Some of his policies on trade can be worrying, except they sound to me more like the beginning of a negotiation. So I've taken the posture of wait and see. I want to give him a chance and see what he does, because the overall thrust of his policy is unbelievably pro-growth for the first time in my recent memory.
After the overheated rhetoric of the campaign, do his economic appointments reassure you so far?
Well, all the people who've been appointed so far to economic appointments are people of accomplishment. They certainly know how the economy works, and I think they're very reassuring. What the team will have to now do is figure out what sequencing they have in mind for policy and getting things done. You know, Washington isn't a business. It's very different, and there will be a need for some coordination.
Do you ever see yourself going back to Washington?
I enjoyed my time in Washington, but I think that's speculation on my part. I think economists have an interesting role to play when they go to Washington, because we are pretty good at being the skunk at the party, as it were, of trying to expose trade-offs and things for consideration.
Now, turning back to the politics of the administration, Trump caused Boeing and then Lockheed Martin stocks to plummet after he tweeted his displeasure with their projects. Do you think that Trump's continuing tweets will become a problem for our markets?
Well, I think it's hard to say at this point, because I'm not sure whether this is a pattern and whether it continues. I mean, obviously, as president, one should emphasize overall policy. But I think one of the geniuses of Mr. Trump, that he displayed well in the campaign, is using modern means of communication to make a point. So, for example, the carrier move, the way I read that is he's saying, I'm doing something to help jobs stay in the United States. Now, that may be symbolic, but it sends a clear message. So I think we don't know yet. But yes, on average, we would hope a president spends more time on policy than on his iPhone.
Wasn't what Trump did with respect to those jobs at Carrier, isn't that a form of industrial policy?
Well, it's certainly the case that you should focus on general policy, as I said. I think what he was doing was trying to send a symbolic message to build support. Oftentimes, politicians do things that we economists don't think are completely clean, but do help to advance their overall message. That's why I say we're just going to have to wait and see if this becomes a habit or an occasional situation.
Now, Trump has loans worth $300 million from Deutsche Bank, at the same time that there are negotiations going on between the bank and the Justice Department over a settlement for misdeeds. Are you concerned about these or other possible conflicts of interest with Trump's business, and what he should do to reassure America's voters?
Well, I don't know the facts of the individual case you mentioned, but the real thing that Mr. Trump should worry about, and I think does, is the court of public opinion. And will people be frustrated with the appearance of or actuality of conflicts? So he is going to have to think this through. We haven't had somebody with this level of business interest as president in a very long time. So I think it's going to take a little while to think through, and he's going to have to get it right.
He served as chair of President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. He's a co-chair of the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation and the Dean and Russell L. Carson Professor of Finance and Economics of the Columbia Business School. Glenn Hubbard will return for part two of this interview next week at this same time. By the way, if any of you have comments about the show or suggestions for topics, please email me at aclosterlook@bloomberg.net. That's a closer look, one word, at Bloomberg.net. And follow me on Twitter, at Arthur Levitt, one word. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 25 minutes past the hour.
This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. Arthur Levitt is a former chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, a Bloomberg LP board member, a senior advisor to the Promontory Financial Group, and a policy advisor to Goldman Sachs.
This week, we continue our closer look at Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia Business School. He's the author of three popular textbooks, as well as co-author of The Economics of Great Powers, From Ancient Rome to Modern America, and Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, 5 Steps to a Better Health Care. He was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush, and in the corporate sector, he's on the boards of ADP, BlackRock, closed-end funds, and MetLife, as well as co-chair of the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation. Glenn, Trump was a harsh critic of Fed Chair Janet Yellen during the election. Do you see Trump as a possible threat to the independence of the Fed?
I think it's much too soon to tell. He was critical of monetary policy. Frankly, many economists, including myself, have been critical too. I think it probably crossed the line to being a little bit personal. I think Chair Yellen is doing the job she thinks is appropriate. I don't think she's doing things for political reasons. But I think we'll have to see how the administration and the Fed get along. The Fed is independent. It's not there to curry favor with the administration. But of course, both the Fed and the administration ultimately answer to the American people.
Now, the nominee for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and other business group leaders are in favor of TPP. How do you feel about this deal, and isn't it important for balance of China's influence in Asia?
Well, I think that's the key reason for TPP. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is really a very good way for the U.S. to reassert itself in Asia, and China will be the winner of our walking away from TPP. The actual trade benefits for the U.S. are relatively modest. We've accomplished most of those, so the world won't end without TPP. But it is a lost bargaining chip for the U.S. I don't see it happening.
Are you at all concerned about the effect of all the negative talk about free trade that took place in the last election?
Well, I think economists need to step up and tell the stories. What's really happening in the job market in America has much less to do with trade and much more to do with technological change. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not a real problem for many Americans, but it calls for very different kinds of support. So I think we have to have an honest discussion about trade, and frankly, not just trade in goods and services and capital, but immigration, where the president-elect has also teed up the issue.
Now, turning to health policy and Obamacare, it appears to me that Congress is finally going to succeed in trying to repeal Obamacare. Now, you wrote a book about health care policy. What do you think should and can replace it, and how would you get everyone insured?
Well, what's interesting, of course, in the healthcare debate is that people focus on two words, cost and access. But if you focus only on access, which is what the Affordable Care Act did, or so-called Obamacare, you get rising costs and the system can break down. That's essentially what we're going through now. Dr. Price, the incoming Secretary of Health and Human Services, has worked long and hard on this in the Congress with models that are very similar to what I've written about and other economists have written about. I would expect it to involve the purchase of insurance across state lines and the use of tax credits to help low-income people be able to afford health insurance. I think this is a big shift from Obamacare, a much less regulatory approach.
How long would it take to feel the impact of such a shift? Undoing an existing regulation is time-consuming, costly, and rife with political free falls.
You're right. It's hard. And I think it would be a matter of working with governors to make sure that funds for low-income households were made available. So I think it is going to be hard, but it's something, obviously, that Dr. Price and his colleagues have been thinking about for a very, very long time. And I think this will happen. You can change the Affordable Care Act through what's called reconciliation in the Senate. So you don't need 60 votes. You just need 51.
Now, Paul Ryan wants to turn Medicare into a voucher program. I think there are legitimate concerns that such a change would make it harder for most seniors to afford care at the time of life when they need it the most.
Well, I'm not sure what Speaker Ryan will wind up proposing. I think that what is important is that we guarantee low-income seniors absolutely full access to the health care they need. I think that a voucher or tax credit from the government to do that is probably the most efficient way to do it. But I don't see why we would give more affluent seniors the same subsidy we give low-income seniors. We can afford important programs like Medicare and indeed Social Security in the country if we focus them on the people who need them the most.
Now, if you had a magic wand that could make Dodd-Frank disappear, would you wave it?
I don't think Dodd-Frank can disappear. The rules are a little bit different, but the good or bad news, depending on your perspective, a lot of it is through regulatory implementation, so just the change in players will help. And I think we need to spend more time thinking about contagion than we did in Dodd-Frank. I don't think the Financial Stability Oversight Council makes us safer. I think the other way around. So I would urge the Congress or the administration to appoint a group of people to say, let's look at what happened again. Let's look at Dodd-Frank and then suggest the changes that we need to make. The good news is many of those changes can be made in regulation.
We'll continue this conversation with economist Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia Business School, in just a moment. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 12 minutes past the hour. This is A Closer Look with Glenn Hubbard, Dean of the Columbia Business School, co-chair of the Committee of Capital Market Regulations. Glenn, we were talking just now about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I recognize the criticism that's been leveled at them. What would you do now in terms of advising the Trump administration how to make the CFPB accountable and yet responsive to consumer needs?
Well, the first thing on accountability, of course, is to have it have to go to the Congress, as every other agency does, for a budget appropriation. That seems to me first stop. But the second would be looking at simplicity as a goal. As you know, a lot of what happened during the financial crisis and in other areas is consumers, particularly consumers of modest means, often have to deal with very difficult to understand financial transactions. And there's a lot we can do to simplify information to consumers.
Now, Social Security is once again on the table. Are there any changes that you believe can practically find their way through in a Trump administration during the early years where we'll have many, many changes and proposals on the table?
I don't see it in the early years simply because the administration, wisely in my view, is really prioritizing a series of pro-growth policies and changes to the Affordable Care Act. So I think it would be unlikely. I think what the president-elect could do, if he chose at some point, is to look at Social Security along the lines I mentioned before of trying to make sure we redirect resources to people who need it most. So tangibly raising minimum benefits, but slowing the rate of growth of benefits for everyone else. But I don't see that anytime soon.
You've said, Glenn, that economics is not just about GDP. It's about social cohesion. Are you concerned as to what happens if we don't succeed in growth that helps people who feel left behind?
I definitely am, Arthur. I think it's the core domestic policy challenge that the new administration and the Congress face. We have a situation where we had an election actually dominated by an ethos of people who feel left behind. In part, it was that the economy isn't growing fast enough, but more specifically, is that their incomes weren't growing fast enough. So we need a policy that raises overall GDP growth, but we've got to do more to support work and aspirations of most Americans, not just a few.
Now, are you personally addressing the rise of populism around the world with your students and what these future business leaders can or should do to mitigate the rising sense of injustice of a rigged system?
Interestingly, it's a great question, and interestingly, we are. We had, I say we, because a faculty colleague and I did sessions with the students before the election on populism, not about the particular candidates, but on the themes and what they needed to think about it as business people. I think that a lot of business school students at top universities like mine need to make sure that they're in touch with the aspirations, the feelings, the emotions of other people who may be their workers, their customers, their suppliers. And I think business school is a good place to start.
What are your students most concerned about these days?
Well, I think they are very concerned about social inclusion and prosperity. They're also concerned about the environment and overall prospects for growth for them. They obviously want to know, is the growth prospect they will achieve over their careers the same as people my age achieved? It's a perfectly reasonable question for them.
Women today can currently hold about 14% of the top five executive positions at each of the S&P 500 companies, and only 4% of CEO jobs. Are there more women getting MBAs at Columbia these days, and what do these young women think about their futures?
Oh, for sure. More than 40% of our students are women. This is a problem that is largely going to work itself out over time because the pool of talented female business school students is very different than it was 25 years ago when many fewer women were in business school. But I think there's more companies can be doing right now to encourage diversity in the executive ranks and the boardrooms. And it's not just out of some vague social concern, although that's important too. It really matters for business. There's plenty of evidence, including by my own colleagues here, to suggest that more diverse leadership teams make more robust and resilient management decisions.
It seems that voters think that companies must feel an allegiance to their employees and to the communities in which they've profited. Do you think it's really fair to ask business to think about something other than maximizing profit?
Well, I think about this in a more complicated way, Arthur. If you want to maximize your long-run viability as a company, the value of your company in the long run, how you treat all of the stakeholders around you makes a difference. The most successful business people I know are heavily engaged in their community and in social interests, sometimes with money, sometimes with contributions of their time. But I'd like to see us go back to a time where business leaders were more broadly engaged. I think the public respects business people, and business people have a lot to offer.
We seem to have fewer of the great names that characterized the business community of the past, the John Whiteheads, the Irving Shapiros, the Reg Joneses. I don't think you could reel off half a dozen names of that broadly recognized community today, do you? And why not?
Well, I think it's different. I had the great privilege for many years of working with John Whitehead on a number of organizations and know that his views must have shaped Goldman Sachs in as much as they shaped all of the world around him. We need business people like that. I think a lot of today's business leaders feel the regulatory environment, the pressure that they are under, gives them too little time. But again, I think they sell themselves short. They have an enormous bully pulpit, and I think business people who can engage are going to find it to their interest and to their company's interest.
He has played important roles in both government and the corporate sector, serving as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of the Treasury and Chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. In the corporate sector, he is a board member of ADP, BlackRock, closed-end funds, and MetLife. Currently, he's the Dean and Russell L. Carson Professor of Finance and Economics of the Columbia Business School. Glenn Hubbard, thanks for a fascinating and far-ranging interview. By the way, if any of you have comments about the show or suggestions for topics, please email me at aclosereloook@bloomberg.net. That's a closer look, one word, at bloomberg.net. And follow me on Twitter, @ArthurLevitt, one word. This is A Closer Look with Arthur Levitt. It's 25 minutes past the hour.